I think you're terribly sanguine. And if I understood you correctly, I was a little surprised.
What?
I'm not sure that you were saying that there was the degree of acceptability that I thought you were saying. Perhaps in certain centers where there's...
What I'm saying is that there is a vision of women, so-called liberated women, and certainly the acceptable gay male and female, who is going to be co-opted and integrated into American capitalist society in general, which will totally deflate any of the really revolutionary aspects of the women's movement and of the gay movement. And I think this is a really very serious problem.
I agree, yeah. Yeah, I think it's a really important study. I agree. I hope people are working on it. I don't know.
Judy, I assume you're saying that sexuality will be depoliticized. And this is what happens if sexuality is depoliticized. There will be that co-optation of the once exotic beast.
If I could comment, I think what's happening is that homosexuality is being desexualized, that there is a tendency at the ideological level on the part both of some elements in the gay movement, some elements in the lesbian movement, and some elements in the straight society, to try to think of homosexuality as having really very little to do with sex. You fall in love with somebody of the same sex, and otherwise it's just like straight people, and you get engaged. You can't get married, but you know, maybe if you change the laws, you can. So I think that there is a certain kind of integration going on. And I think the study of the ways in which the society is attempting to integrate homosexuals and lesbians is very important. On what basis are we being integrated? On what basis are we not being integrated?
The basis of money.
Back, yeah.
I think it's really important to look at and talk about libido in terms of, for instance, how much energy somebody has when they come home from work. You know, if you didn't It's really connected. It's the same human energy we're talking about. There's not the strange thing, libido, and there's your labor power. Labor power and libido, it's exactly the same energy. And, you know, they need to be explored. The connections have to be explored. And that makes it a historical question.
May I just comment on your comment for a minute? First, I'm just not sure that you and I know the same feminists or read the same feminists. Secondly, the feminist analysis of Freud, I think that you're overlooking, rather unfortunately, the developmental aspect of feminist thought. The critique on Freud, which everyone, including you, I believe, would say was necessary and healthy, that stage is past. You can see in someone like Juliet Mitchell, or in some of the French thinkers like Lucie Ragay, you can see a real attempt to have a revisionist, psychoanalytic set of concepts crossed over with a feminist analysis. Secondly, this question about the libido. I don't know if you were talking about me directly or other people out there. Now, I may be a closet Victorian. That may be my real secret. But I don't see that in feminist writing. I don't think that's really there, that return to innocence. I think why you might think it's there is one that in feminist thought, like all politics of hope, there is a certain utopian and mythic strain. And there are projections of certain idyllic communities in which human disharmonies, cruelty, and violence is not there. This aspect of feminist thought shares the characteristics of all utopian political thought. Two, the analysis of the horrors and the trials of sexuality are such that you may think dialectically that there is the denial of sexuality itself, that in the description of pain, there is the repudiation of the thing itself. But I really don't think that's there. The point I was trying to make on the libido is that I think we have to have serious theoretical discussions that you're clearly raising about its viability as a historical concept and as a historical fact. And I think to question it is not to be a frigid purist.
Joe.
Well, I was serious when I was saying before that I think we have to think of human energy and then the different way it's used and really revise our basic thinking on these concepts. I think there's really a connection between Marx's labor power, Reich's orgone, Freud's libido, you know, these things which are usually thought of as so, well, at least the Marx and the Freud are thought of as so different and apart, but there's really a connection and the connection is the use of human energy in different kinds of activity, you know, in the different forms that takes.
Yes.
I make a mistake?
Well, I feel I paid my dues during doing empirical work, and you can read Gay American History. It's all empirical. So I felt I was really free to do some theoretical grand thinking. I think there's a desperate need for theory to start thinking in larger terms and seeing what all this empirical data that we're finding means.
But if I understood you, you really were saying two things. One, what are the intellectual conditions for the construction of viable theory? And one of the points I was trying to make is I think the state of the art of the study of sexuality now is such that we have too many theories and too few simultaneously. And we are in the stage of micro studies out of which the overarching theory will emerge. We're in a forest of paradigms. But the second point you were making, is a point that, if I may say so, comes up at academic conference after academic conference, and it is a characteristic of the study of sexuality at this point in time that it is done within a political and moral framework.
Well, I just have one more comment on that, which I think is that when academics who are paid high salaries, the ones who have gotten tenure,
nice, Jonathan. Don't knock it.
I'm not knocking. I wish I had it. I think that's a politics. I mean, they're doing their research for as part of their being paid to do it in an academic institution. There's a real politics to that. There's no research done anyplace that's pure research. There just isn't any such thing.
Being a historical agent allowed to it, so I'm convinced that the people on the panel and the rest of us know raised a question about these repression of sexuality in some socialist states. It's a serious issue. The conference is called Power and Sexuality, and the questions of state, contending for state power, question of reconstruction of social institutions, interactions beyond what we all choose to do in bedrooms and in public around love affairs. Those issues have to be confronted. There were a few meager attempts to do that in the audience, and then it sort of just dissipated. And I felt that there's either an inability or a resistance for us to face it. I have only some cliches to offer, which I'll keep to myself. But like Jonathan or Kate or anyone else in the room who's maybe been thinking about it in the last half hour or two, once again pick up that very crucial dialogue between first liberation and state power.
Well, just one immediate response is that the right wing is doing a very good job, maybe better than we are, in tying up very diverse issues like their anti-union, anti-ERA, anti-abortion, anti-black, anti-gay, maybe some others too. I mean, they're really doing us a favor in a way, in one way, by making those links which a lot of us have felt sort of intuitively before, and there they are in the newspapers, you know.
Yeah, I'm a gay reaction.
Of course there are.
Well, I guess what I have in mind is something like this, that the state of history is becoming crowded by actors who, all of us, who are demanding our fullest humanity, and we're involved in a joint process of disintegration of American society, at the same time that disintegrating society tries to accommodate each actor as he or she comes on stage. So to think that there's room being made for a acceptable gay type, acceptable feminist type or acceptable radical teacher type, that makes sense given the need to accommodate as things fall apart. That's not shocking, but what interests me more is not how what interests me equally is not really how the system will bend me to avoid breaking, but what do we want to do as we assert ourselves, to reconstruct ourselves as we reconstruct the institutions we're part of? What will it look like as gayness asserts itself and undermines some of the things that form a feminized power structure look like? How will we live it differently?
Yeah, they're marvelous questions. I am caught always when I think about these things between 1984 and Brave New World, between the release of sexuality as a form of control and the restriction of sexuality as a form of control. And I am trying to figure out if the state, a repressive state, which is the more efficient way to go. But the fact that we have those two models suggests to me that there is no simple and reliable correlation between the exercise of state power and the limitations on the expression of individual energy. I may be wrong in this, I'm not a historian, but I think as we discuss, we are insufficiently thinking about the traditions of specific states. We're forgetting about the force of the local. And it seems to me we can't talk about the state in abstract terms and ourselves as intimate creatures in abstract terms. We have to look at the past out of which that particular state has developed. Has there been a church, an influential Catholic church, for example? The question you asked about a feminist power structure, it's always seemed to me from my first days in the movement that what the women's movement could contribute is an analysis of the psychology of power. And it seems to me that is the root, one of the great roots of the problem, and that we would speak in these utopian terms, so reconstitute ourselves that the delights of domination would in some way be defanged. It's sort of hard for me to say that, being an authoritarian personality. This is something I've been thinking about during the discussion, and it seems to me there may be a tension here between women's history and gay history, unless the gay male historians understand heterosexual women or lesbian mothers better. And this is the physiology and psychology of reproduction. And not simply talking about sexuality divorced from reproduction, but that form of sexuality where reproduction and pleasure are bound in varying degrees. And so that when we would try to think about the reconstituted state, we have to think about motherhood and the bearing and the rearing of children and the reconstitution of the nurturing of the helpless.
That's important.
Yes.
I wanted to say something about the question of the relationship between I wanted to say something about your comment. It's slightly different terms. Talking from the perspective of homosexuality. Thinking about it recently, it seemed to me that there is something almost inherently in conflict between homosexuality, as I understand it, and regulation by an organized larger power, which is my way of understanding why homosexuality has been persecuted in what you're calling socialist countries. That is, there are more ways, it seems to me, in which gay people, by definition, are less controllable by systems than at the moment, historically, heterosexuals are, and women are, heterosexuals women. That is, our relationships tend to be between people who are trained to think of each other as peers and equals, male-male or female-female relations, rather than between people who are trained to think of each other in hierarchical terms. As the idea of hierarchy is built into a heterosexuality as it's now defined, or heterosexual relations as they're now defined. And that is not so implicitly, it seems to me, in homosexual relations, although homosexual relations have been often socialized to follow that form. Also, we are not primarily, at least in our primary relationships, we don't procreate biologically and therefore cannot be controlled through the structure of the family or through the structure of parenthood. And we have no forms such as legal marriage, which can be sometimes psychically destructive, but also place upon us total responsibility for our adulthood in a way that heterosexuals have forms obviously given to them for their adulthood. Not that those forms are viable for heterosexuals either, but they can be lulled into thinking they are simply because of the support they get in their orientation.
Yes.
What I mean is that, to me anyway, there's a kind of positive anarchy implied in homosexuality that is inherently in conflict with the idea of strict or excessive regulation by a state. And to the degree that forms of socialism we're familiar with now, state socialism, require codification and regularity, require that everyone be in his or her place, performing his or her function, homosexuality would be very threatening because it's harder to keep us in certain places.
Joe, I think you're saying several things there.
Thank you.
One, I'm just not so sure. Let me tell you my quibble with you, and then let me tell you where I think I began to follow you more fully. I quibble with you into saying that hierarchy is built into heterosexuality in a way it's not built into homosexuality. I'm just not sure that's true. I would say differentiation tends to be built into heterosexuality in a way it's not built into homosexuality. But I'm simply not sure about hierarchy. Where I would agree with you is to say there's a legalization of hierarchy in heterosexuality that there's not in homosexuality. I couldn't agree with you more about your definition of the homosexual male or female is the outlaw, the system breaker, who is necessarily thrown into the existential jungle and misshaped personality with all the connotations for anarchy that implies. But is the homosexual the system breaker for some innate reason? Or is the homosexual the system breaker because the system has said, go away? And if the system changes, then that valorization of the homosexual will necessarily change too.
Yeah, I think what I'm saying is the former. I'm arguing for something inherent. That is not just this system that we live under, but the systems we live under now, but there's something inherently oppositional to the idea of a system.
So are you saying that's because of sexuality, or using homosexual as a metaphor now?
No.
Joe, read The Advocate, the current issue. I was just reading a story about the most establishment gay male. I mean, I think you're really being romantic and ahistorical, and you should be. You should be historical.
Okay, we have one more question.
For example. Yeah, but okay. I think too that homosexuality and the gay movement is not a manifestation of a universal death wish. I don't think anybody in this room thinks that homosexuality is calling for an apocalyptic end to history. And its means will be having no children. I think your description of homosexuality was, if you'll forgive me, a tiny bit melodramatic. But I think though this...
Excuse me.
Excuse me.
Excuse me.
The purpose, may I say so, the purpose of the artificial insemination was to have a family.
Yeah. Excuse me, the floor's not open to... I can't, I've got to clear up here.
There are questions about the family,
yeah,
so what's the end of children?
It's a short question.
I really need to close up.
The other people have their hands.
I need to finish here. I do. We'll have a whole day tomorrow and a lot of interaction, please. Okay? But for tonight, thank you. Before we do close, there are three persons who are here from Swarthmore, and they thought they'd have accommodations and don't. If anybody can help us out in finding a place for a conference participant, please see one of our staffers then, okay? And be open tomorrow at 9:30 with coffee and more of this. Thank you for coming tonight.